The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Avery Schmitz, intern at Lawfare, and an episode of Chatter for May 14th, 2023. For today's episode, the Lawfare team decided to cross-post this week's episode of Chatter, a podcast from David Priest and Shane Harris, featuring in-depth discussions with fascinating people at the creative edges of national security. Today's Chatter episode is entitled Politicians and White House Plumbers with Olivia Nuzzi. In the episode, Harris sat down with Olivia to discuss her career, the 2024 presidential election, her new podcast detailing the Watergate scandal, and more. This is Chatter.
This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, journalist Olivia Nuzzi on politics and White House plumbers.
I was really fascinated by politics. I watched a lot of late night comedy, and it used to drive me crazy if I didn't get the joke, you know, in like a Letterman monologue or something. Okay. And so I really started paying attention to the news in order to be on the joke.
Yeah.
I remember when I first learned about Watergate, that it was such a tiny, stupid thing. And I could not believe that something so minor had snowballed because of their stupidity.
Right, that it broke the
dam. Yeah, that it broke everything. I could not believe that. With Trump, he doesn't handle boredom well.
Yeah.
And instead of horse racing or bocce or something, this is his sport, is fucking with American politics.
Yeah. We're rolling now. We could just use this.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I could do a fancy intro for you, Olivia Nuzzi, or we could just say hi.
Nuzzi. It's Nuzzi.
Nuzzi. What did I say?
Nuzzi.
I said Nuzzi. I know how to pronounce your name.
Don't mock me.
Listen, Nuzzi. It's a Nuzzi. Do people mispronounce your name all the time?
Yeah, but there's even dispute within my family about it.
Really?
Yeah. Some people say Nuzzi, and some, the Italian way is Nuzzi.
Because it's like TZ, or like the double Z makes Nuzzi. It Nuzzi.
Yeah.
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 Okay, fine.
Do people mispronounce your name?
All the time. Actually, you know what they do? They call me Sean.
I called you Sean the other day when I was talking to Ryan.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We've mispronounced each other's names now.
But that's just a different name. It's not
it's a completely different name. People call me Kyle. No.
I was thinking, do you look like a Kyle? You don't look like a Kyle.
I don't think so.
No.
Yeah. But you're a podcaster now.
Oh, God, yeah.
You are podcasting the companion to the HBO series White House Plumbers.
Yes.
Which is this great show about these people who redecorate bathrooms in the White House. It's excellent. We're going to talk about all that. You and I go way back.
Yeah, we do. I can't believe, I was thinking when I was coming over here and being very late that I can't believe we ever worked at the Daily Beast. It's such a weird place.
It is a weird place.
It's like Grand Central Station for journalists.
A lot of people went through there. I was there with you, and see, Jackie Kucinich was there. Mm-hmm. Noah Shachtman was the editor. Swin Subasang was there. Tim Mack was there.
Yeah.
Now, who's like freelancing for himself at in Ukraine.
Nina Strolik at National Geographic.
Will O'Connor.
Will O'Connor.
Who's the travel editor now.
Yeah.
Who else went through there? Who are the crazy
Scott
people?
Scott Bixby.
Yes.
Speaking of crazy people.
John Avalon was the editor for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good time. Let's talk about where you grew up. I want to get to how you got into the business, but like...
It's like inside the actor's studio.
Yeah, see, right.
Where were you born?
Where is the young Nootsie from?
I was born New York, mm-hmm. and I was raised in New Jersey, in Red Bank, which is like an hour and 15 minutes from Manhattan.
It's like suburban New Jersey. Yeah. And yeah. What was your childhood like growing up?
I was kind of a loner.
Yeah.
And I hated being a child.
Uh-huh, I did too.
Yeah, I was very frustrated by that. Yeah, I felt older then than I feel now, though, definitely.
Oh,
like, I felt very old and sort of weighed down always.
Did you want to hang out with the adults more than the kids?
It never even occurred to me to, like, hang out with the kids, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. But I didn't, I don't know, no one ever really talked to me like I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, everyone always sort of related to me as a miniature adult.
Did you get the thing where people would say, she's so mature?
Yeah, which I hated that, because I felt like, because you guys are fucked up, so you're, like, making me that way.
I'm not like you. Just be clear, I'm nothing like you. Did you want to be a journalist or a writer?
I wanted to be a writer. Uh-huh. I was going through a box of stuff recently from my mother, and like there was some little, fourth grade or fifth grade thing where I wrote, for my future writer, which I was sort of surprised by because I didn't remember that being a conscious desire.
Like you actually sat down and wrote something intentionally.
I was always writing short stories, mm-hmm. and writing scripts, and writing anything really in any format, and sort of trying different things out.
Were your scripts, were they like for like school plays?
Were for sitcoms. I watched a lot of sitcoms. And was sort of, like raised by Nick at
ones?
Night.
Oh,
I Love Lucy.
Okay, classic.
I liked Bewitched. I loved Gilligan's Island.
Oh, wow.
And I feel I don't really like boats to this day because
of
Gilligan's Island.
You're afraid of them?
A 3-hour tour, it could only go wrong.
Yes.
What else?
Did you watch any contemporary shows or did you like the classics?
I watched a lot of television.
Yeah.
I was like really raised by television.
Were you a Three's Company fan?
I loved Three's Company, of course. I can't wait to look for, like, Mrs. Roper in a couple of years.
I have an idea.
In 6 months.
I want to wear some Mr. Farley, like, ascots.
Yeah. There are a lot of good looks on that show.
I had this idea for a show, which we should totally do. It'd be an update. There should be a show called The Regal Beagle. And it's just, but it's like, you go back and you set it in that era.
Yeah.
But you build it around The Regal Beagle.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the bar.
Yeah, a lot of intrigue.
Yeah, and you could have whole new characters. Like, Jack could show up. Yeah. Larry could be there, whatever. Yeah. But you would just build it around that.
Yeah, there should be, like, a Cheers.
Yeah. Or it could be a six-part limited series. Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I love Cheers. But you don't like Cheers. Why?
I like Cheers a lot. It was not one that I watched religiously.
I'm looking at you through this thing, and it's weird. It's
very Well, Cheers has the Woody Harrelson connection. Which
You know, I totally forgot that he was
played
in it.
Woody.
Yeah.
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 That was, and it was funny because like he played like, he was, it's interesting, they were taking the stereotype of the dumb blonde and making it a man.
Yeah.
Which I think was like totally novel for that era. It was
radical.
Kind of controversial. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good.
Loved Frasier. Speaking of Cheers.
Show.
Yeah.
I watched a lot of dramas when I was young. So, like, I liked St. Elsewhere.
I've never seen that.
The hospital show. It's very good.
I don't like hospital shows.
It's kind of like if Hill Street Blues were a hospital show. They were on, I think, around the same time anyway. Mm. It's not quite, like, gory like ER. It's like not like hospital room drama. It's more the people in the hospital.
I watched a lot of Law & Order and, like, procedurals like that.
Yeah.
A lot of Law & Order.
So then, as you grow up, do you think, okay, journalism is for me? How do you land in journalism? Tell us.
We really got sidetracked. Ranking sitcoms. I didn't know any journalists. Nobody in my family had ever had a job, to my knowledge, where, like, thinking was the primary activity in the job. It was mostly, manual
labor
and... hairdressers and waitresses, mm-hmm. and my dad worked for the sanitation department in New York. And so it was just not, I never knew that was an option, and then I was really fascinated by politics. I watched a lot of late night comedy, mm-hmm. and it used to drive me crazy if I didn't get the joke. you know, in like a Letterman monologue or something. Okay. And so I really started paying attention to the news in order to be in on the joke.
And then
it was so much more pleasurable to watch comedy when I knew what the hell people were talking about.
Right.
And so I wanted to get involved in local politics. Mm-hmm. And so when I was in high school.
Still in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, New Jersey. I started volunteering for local campaigns. Mm-hmm. And it was just the most fun. And at this point, I had like a little blog that I where I would kind of write little missives about politics.
What year was this?
2009,
okay.
10,
yeah.
probably.
So Obama's in the White House, blogging is big.
Yeah, and I would write for like Open Salon, and people were so encouraging. People were so nice. And I didn't know what reporting was or what reporting looked like, but I was kind of like, in retrospect, veering towards acts of journalism.
I went to
like a Tea Party meeting and like, you know, pretended like I was volunteering.
You're showing up there like you're like 17 at this point? Did they think this was strange, or was that like,
I looked so old. I mean, I really have looked, I looked 25 from the time I was like 13.
And you'd cover, you probably carried yourself not like a teenager.
Yeah, so everyone was always shocked to learn how old I was. And then I was interning for this local campaign in what was then the legislative district 11 in central coastal New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I had this blog, and this local Republican blogger who had this website called More Monmouth Musings came across my internet presence and asked me if I would be like the dissenting liberal voice for his Republican blog.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, sure. Cool. He said he couldn't pay me. And I was like, all right, well, sure. His
name
is Art Gallagher. And I wrote a piece that was attack. It was called Carolyn's or Casa Grande's Cowardice.
Oh.
And it was about this Republican legislator who I believe it was that she was refusing to give an answer on whether or not she supported gay marriage.
Okay.
And I thought it was bullshit. And and it was
– You had to do real reporting for that too, probably.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't remember there being real reporting. I think I was just like really just being very bitchy to this woman for a couple hundred words. And then from there, the publisher of an alt-weekly in Asbury Park, New Jersey, Dan Jacobson, it's called the Tri-City News, he reached out to see if I would become a columnist there.
Wow.
So I started writing about – it was mostly about Chris Christie, and mm-hmm. he was sort of, you know, gearing up to be a candidate in 2012, and that was sort of the subtext of his entire governorship at that point.
Right.
So it was a lot of like sort of, I don't know, pop punditry about American politics and the presidential race and the primary.
So did you feel like you were developing a voice at that point?
Yeah, but I realized very, very quickly that I did not have as many opinions as I thought that I did, and I was not ideological the way that I thought that I was.
Huh.
And so I ran out of things to say almost immediately, which of course I was, you know, 18.
Sure.
And I found it, you know, tremendously difficult to come up with opinions. And then I realized, well, I don't have opinions on this stuff. I would need to learn more about it and get more experience.
And I
thought that maybe I wanted to be a speechwriter. I was still sort of like, do I want to be in politics or writing about it?
Yep.
And then I took an internship with Anthony Weiner's campaign.
Yes. You want to tell that story?
I thought at that point I had freelanced a bit, you know, for like the Huffington Post, which there was no barrier to entry whatsoever to freelance for the Huffington Post
and this
at that
was,
time.
Exactly. This was a time when basically it was anybody who wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that was really the process.
Right.
Was,
exactly.
There was no
They'll
process.
Take all comers. Yeah, exactly.
And then I think like alternate, some like really lefty, I think now largely forgotten types of places.
Right.
And when I applied to be an intern for the Anthony Weiner campaign, I thought, you know, what better place to learn about media and politics at the same time than on this fucking mayoral race?
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, well, there's no way that they're going to have me because my only experience is writing about politics, or they're going to think that I'm there as a plant. And to my surprise, they immediately emailed me, but I didn't realize that like interns aren't vetted. You know, I thought like, oh, the intern's the most important.
Yes, exactly.
Most important role.
When will the FBI do my background check?
And they told me to, you know, show up to Almond, Anthony Weiner's brother's restaurant in, I think, the Flatiron District, and, you know, to start work.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And then I was there, I mean, for a very brief period of time. And I think actually right around this time, I was introduced to someone named Paul Carr by Dave Weigel, who was the editor of a publication called NSFW Corp.
Oh,
and they
okay.
were going to have me do some freelance pieces. And that kind of intersected with my joining the Anthony Weiner campaign.
Right, right.
So throughout that, I was having conversations with an editor, not thinking I was going to write about it,
right.
But I was taking notes.
Right.
And I was leaking a little bit.
A little bit, just a little bit.
Because it was such a small,
yeah.
I mean, it was a tiny, you were yeah. in like a little, at one point we were working out of his congressional office,
yeah.
Which was just, it was this tiny little space with just a few people and the candidate, and I couldn't believe the things coming out of people's mouths, and it was just delightful.
Had you ever worked that closely instead of political operation before?
Not with a principal
okay.
that was
yeah,
like
yeah.
important.
Well, and especially one who is as colorful and
right.
weird as he is.
So I'd worked with like the candidates that I'm still friends with from
yeah.
the local campaign that I interned on. I was like the worst intern ever. I was so bad at phone banking and so bad at all of that shit because I have no attention span
yeah, right.
and no dedication to the cause. I was just like interested, you know, I wasn't like fighting for my life out
there.
I'm
just here to get material.
I didn't know that, but yeah, in retrospect.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just fascinating. I was totally fascinated
yeah.
by it. And yeah, he was such a character.
Totally.
And I was keeping notes just because it was so interesting. And then I believe it was when Sidney Leathers was exposed by BuzzFeed as
mm-hmm.
being a woman that he was having a sexting relationship
mm-hmm.
with. And the campaign was obviously over. Paul Carr, who was my editor at that time, said, he called me and he said, if you don't write about this, you're a bad journalist and I'm a worse editor. And so we decided
so
that it was okay to write about it. So I did a couple little episodic things. But he called all the female interns Monica, which I thought was absolutely hilarious and deranged. And you know, people were only working there to really get proximity to Huma for the potential Hillary
yeah.
Clinton campaign.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I heard from the New York Daily News. I actually heard from Annie Carney, someone that I think
yeah,
we're both friends.
Know.
Yeah,
yeah.
Who was at the Daily News and had seen some pickup of some of my items
wow.
and wanted to know if I would write a piece for them.
Wow.
Or nice. I believe she wanted to write a piece, and I said, how about I write a piece?
Okay. I didn't know Annie was that connection to that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I met with her for coffee at the Empire Hotel in Lincoln Center.
You're like, I'll write it.
Well, I didn't know. It's funny. I talked to her about this not that long ago, and her telling of like what that was like from her side was so funny because, of course, it seemed insane. There's like this, you know, child writer being like holding a paper hostage. And she introduced me to the political editor there, Joel something, and they told me that, you know, my rules were that they weren't going to use my photo,
okay.
they weren't going to make this into some sort of like trashy intern reveals all type of
right.
thing. But the
right.
big thing was I didn't want them to use my photo because I didn't want it to seem like a tabloidy.
Like
even
you
though
were
I
exploiting this.
I also didn't know that the Daily News was a tabloid because my father.
Oh,
would,
that's interesting.
My father would bring home the New York Post and the New York Daily News
yep.
every day, and compared to the New York Post, the Daily News seemed like a relatively serious
yeah.
publication.
You just grew up around it, yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't occur
so
to me that was a tabloid.
Yeah.
And so I wrote the story. Their edits on it were so infuriating and so brain dead that I almost pulled the plug on it and brain dead, pulled the plug. Such
yeah.
morbid. Jesus.
I slaughtered them.
Oh, God. But I was really frustrated because I felt like they were turning it into a very silly thing.
Right.
And it was a kind of a serious piece of reporting.
Yeah.
I thought it was all about the kind of machinations of the people and why they were working on the campaign.
Well, impressioned, as it turns out.
And what they thought of the candidate, which is not much.
Yeah.
And,
right, right.
And then they contacted me and they asked me for a headshot because, like all of their columnists, they were going to run a small headshot, is what they told me. And I kind of, without a second thought, sent it over. My friend Sophia, who's a photographer, had taken a bunch of photos for me. They were actually kind of parody photos where we were doing like a, like, what would a female Stephen Colbert look like? And so I got a spray tan and I looked, you know, insane.
Oh, my God.
They asked me for a higher resolution then on the photo, and I thought that was a little weird, but yeah. I didn't know anything about this, yeah. So I didn't think it was weird enough that I was like, why do they need such a high resolution on this photo? And then I learned later.
You had some other options as well.
Yeah, I learned later that they had a staff meeting where they said, like, we're going to put her on the cover. What are the odds that she sues and goes crazy? And they decided, it's probably going to be good for her career. So fuck it, we'll do it, and we'll roll the dice. Harry Siegel told me that because he was on I think he was on the board, the editorial board. And I woke up, really early because I was waiting for it to come out, and I was really excited.
Your byline and everything.
Yeah, and more than that, I woke up to a phone call from my father saying, "Why are you on the cover of the Daily News?"
Get out.
Just very cool and collected. Why are you on the cover of the Daily News?
Oh my God.
And I ran. I was living in a dorm at Fordham University in Lincoln Center at the time, and I ran out and tried to buy up every paper that I could find on the Upper West Side. I was running up and down the Upper West Side because I was mortified because it looked like it was this photo of me, which transferred horribly to newsprint.
Right.
And next to a photo of Anthony Weiner. And I believe it said something like Weinturn or something horrible. And it looked like I was in a sex scandal with him. And below that was a Real Housewife of New Jersey and her husband, and they were going to jail.
Oh my God.
So I was just horrified, and I thought I looked like shit. I looked like I had sold my story and been photographed by a tabloid.
Yeah, you looked like an opportunist.
Yeah, and that was what the initial pickup of the story was. Yep. The punditry about the story was sort of like this social climby woman selling her gossip to a tabloid, which is exactly what I wanted to avoid. So I was devastated. Yeah. And then at about 7 p.m. that day, I started getting all of this incoming from someone named Hunter Walker, who I'd never heard of before, and I was just terrified. Yeah. I had no idea what he wanted to talk to me about, and he didn't say specifically, and I was like, who the fuck is this person? And I didn't know what to do. I just remember shaking.
Where was he at the time?
Talking Points Memo.
Talking Points Memo. Okay.
And I had, I knew what Talking Points Memo was because I watched a lot of MSNBC. And, but I was just terrified. And then when I finally spoke to him and he told me why he was calling, I can't remember if we must have been on the phone. And he told me that the campaign communications director had gone on the record to call me a series of absolutely deranged, hilarious names, including, may I?
Of course.
Slutbag, fucking twat, little cunt.
Oh my God.
Definitely called me a bitch. There were all of these.
I knew there were some names, but not that many.
Well, I had never heard slutbag before. And to my knowledge, she may have, Barbara Morgan, who I'm now very good friends with, actually, may have coined that term. And I thought it was just delightful. I really genuinely appreciated the creativity. But
she
more
reached
than
deep.
That,
yeah, she
but
went
more
deep.
Than that, I mean, very cynically, I thought, well, this absolves me. I look like an angel now.
Because you're being attacked.
I look like an angel now. And so, I think everyone was very oh, no, she's being bullied. Is she going to be upset?
Right.
And I took great pride in it. I thought it was great. Hilarious.
Because
turn
you
of
provoked
events.
Them? As a
No, I just, well, maybe a bit, but I mostly just thought it was so funny.
Yeah.
And I thought that the creativity involved was so good, so funny. And I thought it was kind of just a great story, a delightful story. And I felt like, okay, I no longer look like the villain in this
There's
situation.
There's some vindication for you in it, right? Exactly.
Yeah, but I was not prepared for how it would turn into. I mean, it really turned into an international story for – I had never experienced anything like it. There were reporters outside my parents' house, just everyone in the world asking me to come on – television, go on Good Morning America, go on like all of these British and Australian shows, and go on late night. Go, like, I just kept getting all of this incoming for days and days. Right. And I was very worried about my family. Yeah. And then I realized, oh, they're Italian. I don't have to worry. They locked it down immediately. No one said a word. And then after three, I went radio silent because I was afraid that if I talked publicly about it, that it would be very difficult to like escape the Anthony Weiner intern sure. thing, which it was for years afterwards, sure. actually. But after 3 days, it was just crickets, which yeah. I thought was so fascinating.
You saw from the inside, yeah, the cycle.
Totally. Yeah. And it was so fascinating to be written about. I'm yeah. really grateful that I had the yeah. experience. I was very upset about it for a couple of years after yeah. because it was really hard every time I wrote something to overcome the just Anthony Weiner intern, famous for betraying an Anthony right. Weiner campaign.
Right, right.
But I'm really grateful because it was the way in which the like logical leaps that people take when they're writing, you know, you went to a school, that means you graduated from the school, or so it, just a way that
like things they got wrong about you,
yeah, but little things that amounted to an incorrect narrative, yeah,
right,
or just you could see how someone would think, oh, you grew up there, so you were born there, born in this
I
town,
see.
Right, and like
yep.
little things that were only, it would only matter to me that it was wrong, but yeah. I thought it was a really valuable
you
lesson
went to school
as a reporter,
on that. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and it was fascinating too. It was yeah. just absolutely fascinating to see how you can just become an avatar
mm-hmm.
and people are talking about you and it literally has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, yeah. But this is it's just so interesting to hear you talk about this because I think one of the things that like very much characterizes the work that you do now, which is really, I mean, you know, people know a lot of the work that you've done on Trump and people in the Trump orbit for these great stories from New York Magazine. Who? Kian? It's
who
like they are assiduously reported, right? And there are times where they are doing crazy shit that even seems outrageous for Rudy Giuliani or Donald
yeah.
Trump. And you read your story and you can tell that you've got it right. It's reported. I mean, you have them saying things. I mean, you have them saying things to you that sometimes mm-hmm. you're like, why in the world are they saying this? And of course, they do. But like, it strikes me that being in the middle of a media circus yourself and mm-hmm. seeing how it's covered probably has instructed you on A, why that's a fascinating story, but B, that you really do need to get it right, every little detail.
Yeah, I think and if I get the tiniest thing wrong, I'm just devastated
exactly.
by it.
Exactly.
I mean, it doesn't happen a lot, thankfully.
Yeah.
But it was very, it definitely was an important experience.
Yeah. And you went from there to the Beast, right?
Because Bridgegate happened. And
yes.
so the timing of that was extraordinarily lucky because there was all of this interest in me from editors and reporters in like
yep.
the New York media scene.
Yep. Yeah.
And I think a lot of it was just like a curiosity, you know, is this person for real? And
mm-hmm.
And then when Bridgegate happened, I had met all of these different people, or I had, you know, been introduced to people over email, and
right.
I was able to turn that into freelancing pretty
prolifically.
You were living
in New York.
I was living in
yeah.
New York, and I started writing for New York Magazine and for Politico magazine.
Right.
Our friend Denise Wills.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Denise published you there. That's right.
And a New Jersey reporter at the time, Matt Katz, had introduced me to Denise because he didn't have the bandwidth to do some
that's
assignment
amazing.
On Christie. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, and it was just very lucky.
Yeah,
timing.
But it's also so much how journalism works, as you know, you're the right place, right time.
Yeah, I happen to have a lot of knowledge
yep.
about New Jersey politics at like the exact moment where that was very valuable. And
yeah.
from there, I got a full-time job at the Beast.
Yeah, right. Just where
yeah.
we met.
Yeah.
And then you were in Washington.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll talk about White House plumbers, but I want to talk about Trump a little bit.
yeah.
Okay, so, okay, first of all, he's in the news a little bit.
Yeah,
today.
He is in the news a little bit today.
Some stuff happened in New York
yeah.
yesterday. And some stuff's going to happen tonight
yeah.
When he is interviewed by Caitlin Collins.
Yeah, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire CNN. He's running, obviously.
From what?
like political handicapping and predictions is so lame. But
yeah.
like if you had to bet right now, like do you think he'll actually be the nominee?
I'm not a betting woman.
You're not a betting woman?
But
what needs to happen for him to be the nominee?
I think circumstances right now, even given the E. Jean Carroll decision, are pretty advantageous for him to be the Republican nominee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it looks very, very – it's hard to imagine a universe in which he does not become the Republican nominee.
And there's no one really running against him. DeSantis has not said he's running.
No, not yet.
It's getting a little late.
Is it?
I mean, Biden's already announced. Trump isn't. When did he come down the escalator? What point in the cycle was that?
June 16th, 2015.
2015. Okay. So in this, if we're comparing cycles, yeah. DeSantis still has a little bit of time.
I think, I mean, it's difficult though, right? The first debate is in August. Mm-hmm. So I think you need to be active. I mean, he's going to Iowa. He's doing the early state visits now that the legislative session is over in Florida, right? DeSantis. Yeah. So I think we'll probably have an announcement sometime in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
But not that they share anything with reporters.
Right, right. You know? But you've spent so much time thinking about him and talking to him and people in his orbit.
I spent more time thinking about his brain than he has, certainly.
Right. Well, yeah, that's probably true. Yeah. So why does he want to be president again?
I've asked him about this. I think that he just doesn't know when you once you ascend to the top of the mountain, I don't think that when you're that old and you've reached whatever heights you wanted to reach as a public figure, there's no other mountain for him to go after, right? I think the post-presidency is so interesting in general as a subject, right? And now lifespans maybe are longer, and presidents previously at least were getting younger, and there was a, you know, there's a lot of runway for someone after that, like Barack Obama or George W. Bush. But with Trump, I mean, he doesn't handle boredom well.
Yeah.
And instead of horse racing or taking up bocce or something, this is his sport, is fucking with American politics.
Yeah.
And I don't think that he knows how to adjust to a life in which he's not sitting at a big desk and his office is now Grand Central Station every day.
Right, right, right. And I think the boredom part is key, right?
I don't think he can tolerate it.
No, he can't sit still.
Yeah, he can't. And he also just needs constant affirmation. He needs attention, and he's not really he hasn't really been getting it that much.
Do you think that the potential for criminal, like, let's say he's criminally indicted in J6 or Mar-a-Lago or both, whatever, which seems like a genuinely real possibility.
Again.
Right. Yeah. Is that debilitating, do you think? I mean, from your understanding of Republican politics today?
I kind of think that, if anything, I mean, what happened with Bragg sort of seemed to strengthen him. I mean, it did strengthen him if you look at the polls for whatever they're worth. I don't know where we stand on polling this time around, right?
Polls are polls, right?
But I kind of think anything that feeds into his narrative that this is a witch hunt and that they're out for him is probably pretty good for galvanizing his base.
Right, right. So if he's president again, think about
Jesus Christ?
You just answered the question. I was gonna say, like, how do you think about, like, saddling up again to cover him? I mean, I think about this a lot more from the perspective of, like, because I cover the intelligence community, like the policy kind of angle this and all that. How do you think you would cover him and write about him differently?
Yeah.
And I suppose that's going to be true even while he's running, he's the nominee. I mean, you're going to be writing about him.
Yeah. I mean, my approach in the last year, I've written like 3 features about him in the last year, and I think my approach has been slower, if that's possible for me. I've tried much harder to contextualize his speech and to not get, I guess, sort of wound up by the crazy shit that he says,
where it's like you just
want to print what he's saying. But, and I still want to do that. I still think that's the answer, is just transparency and putting candidates out there and letting them talk, and people are smart enough to go through what they're saying.
Yeah.
And obviously fact-checking is important, context is important, but I'm not afraid of allowing a candidate to speak.
Sure.
But I definitely, I guess I see him more fully now, I think, and I think we all do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big important thing for me, is making sure that I'm not, like, treating him too unseriously, even though he's such an unserious person.
Right. And I think about this, like from in a newsroom, I mean, where you write and the writing you do, you're expected to have a point of view, right?
Yeah.
And to contextualize and to add some, like, sort of dimensionality of the writer to it. And in the news business, we're so trained to just almost, like, act as if we are not the ones actually writing the words and covering him. And it's impossible to write about this man and not in the context of he tried to stop the transition of power. And he's been credibly convicted of sexual assault. And he may be indicted. Like, you come with your history and, like, that is indebly part of it.
Well, it just, it makes everything feel so heavy, just very from heavy, a pure, just, heavy. You know, creative standpoint, right? Yeah. There's no agile Trump story that you can write. And someone was interviewing me recently, and they were talking to me about my sentence structures. And they were talking about these very long paragraphs I'll do with, you know, that are maybe one or two sentences, which I don't think is a good thing. It's just I was thinking about it because I've never thought about it consciously. And I was just like, well, I don't know how else to fit in all of the different investigations that are ongoing, all of the different alleged crimes that have been committed, all of the different crazy shit that he has done or that has gone on around him in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Yeah.
I don't – it is a run-on sentence.
Absolutely.
It is a run-on thought.
Well, there's no point in trying to, like, to run away from it or to hide it or to
overlook it. Yeah. I mean, I'm always thinking – I love old magazines and I collect magazines and I get so infuriated when I'm reading a big, like, ambitious profile in a magazine from the 70s or 80s or something, and I don't know what the hell they're talking about, and I have to be, you know, on Wikipedia or whatever during it. And so I'm always conscious of trying to write things for people who are not, you know, terminally online and of this moment and tethered to the news cycle. And it's there's a lot of context to add, and it's just this ensemble of characters that is just no one ever goes away. It's just bloated and growing and growing and growing, and it's like, oh, you thought that you could forget about Michael Cohen or an Omarosa or whoever, and it turns out no, you cannot, and they will be relevant until he stops being relevant. And there's not enough newsprint in the world.
I wonder if I wonder a lot about how the government will respond to him if he is president again, and how we kind of even grapple with this individual possibly being president again. I also think, and this is, I mean, predictions are worthless, I don't think he can be reelected. That's just my prediction now is he can't be reelected.
I don't know.
I think he can be, but I don't think he will be.
I keep thinking, though, that at the time that he lost the 2020 race, it was impossible to escape the consequences of his presidency every day, even if it was just surface level, even if you were not someone who was who felt that his policies were really bad or that he was an embarrassment. He was everywhere all the time.
Yep.
He was inescapable. And that's not the case right now, right? He's not on Twitter. He's not on cable news 24/7.
Right.
We're not here. You have to look for his statements and his what do they call them? The truths.
Yes, exactly.
Right, you have to look for it. I think that's kind of a recipe for, if that continues apace, for people not really remembering viscerally how sick of him they were.
Right. So it's not that he becomes irrelevant. It's just that we don't forget how bad he is.
Yeah, and I mean, right now the Democratic Party.
Oh, we forget about it.
Yeah, the Democratic Party and the Trump campaign are sort of aligned in attacking Ron DeSantis, and I keep thinking, like, is that going to look smart in retrospect?
Right. Maybe we should build him up. But I think clearly Biden thinks he can beat Trump, right?
So I mean, he's done it once before.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's why my only prediction on saying I don't think he'll be reelected is I think the math is the math and it'll still be tight. But I don't imagine Donald Trump suddenly reversing his failures with college-educated women in, you know, swing districts. And that's going to kind of decide the election again.
No, I mean, we'll see.
Yeah. Are you excited about the potential of writing about him again, or does it feel exhausting?
No, it feels utterly exhausting. I mean, I've always...
Like the young reporters expended all your opinions?
I feel like I have to see him through as a story.
Yeah.
You know, when I signed on to start writing about him at the Daily Beast in 2014,
right.
I did not think that it was going to be a decade, God, a third of my life, right? But I feel very much like a sense of duty about it, and like I have to see it through. I cannot abandon the story before it's concluded.
Yeah. Well, I think that yours is also a unique voice writing about him. And so Thanks. It's like we want to read what you have to
but
say.
But that
about
last
him.
Piece I did about him, I guess the last piece I did about him was really about Stormy Daniels. Yeah. But the story before that was about him sort of in isolation at Mar-a-Lago.
Oh, my God. The Norma Desmond story.
The Norma Desmond.
I love that story so much. My God. No, but it really is, Olivia. It's like the perfect analogy.
It's crazy. I'm not the first person to make that comparison, obviously.
But it's like, but I mean, when you think about it, like him just like sitting down there, you know, in the dark. Like, oh, my God. With a dead monkey someplace.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Okay, not that part.
But
it is that craving. It's that yearning.
It killed me, though, to write that piece.
Why?
It was like, because it's just so heavy. It's so much has happened. And and also the reporting is just, it's so joyless. And so, you know, not that it should be fun to report on these things or anything like that, but it's just, it is such agony to have to do the reporting. Like, I found myself just being like, oh, fuck, I don't want to call this. I do not want to speak to this person.
Right.
I do not want to speak to this person. Then you have to say, oh, hi.
Hi, it's me.
Hey.
How
you
been?
Oh, great. Okay, yeah, no, I've been great. Thank you. Yeah. No, it's great to talk to you, too. Yeah.
It's so much fun.
Yeah, so that, I mean, it's just, it's painful.
Yeah.
It's painful.
So this is it's kind of a good transition to talk about Watergate and White House plumbers. Mm. I wonder, like, when you think about having to put yourself back in the mindset of thinking about the Nixon era, which really, I mean, I think is the last time. I mean, you could take Iran-Contra as a period of scandal, but like really, and Monica Gate and whatever. But really, since Trump, the only comparable figure has been Nixon in terms of just the scandals, the corruption, et cetera, the impeachment. So when you're thinking about how to talk about Watergate, do you have Trump in mind? Or does it seem like an era ago and something that is kind of like, what connections come up for you?
Yeah, I think like the small ball nature of it is it's impossible to not think of Trump. Like, I remember when I first learned about Watergate, it taking me like 7 tries to finally comprehend that no, all that it was the break-in, and like it was, they just were idiots, and it was such a tiny little stupid thing, and I could not believe that something so minor had snowballed because of their stupidity.
Right, that it broke the
that
dam,
it broke yeah that it broke everything. I could not believe that. And that sort of just stunning, awe-inspiring stupidity. And just the completely psychotic ideological commitment and sort of religious commitment to a leader, I think is very reminiscent of Trump.
And the show White House Plumbers, which is, I mean, it focuses on G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, right? As sort of these two characters.
Two men with initials in their names. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's kind of, it's using them as the vehicle for telling a story about Watergate. How do you think that the way they're doing it on the show and what you want to do on the Companion podcast is like approaching Watergate from in a way that maybe people aren't as familiar with? Or
I think it's fascinating because it's really about these two men and their relationship and their families.
Mostly
about E. Howard Hunt's family. There's less about Liddy's family, but the stuff about Liddy's family is fascinating. But I think it's such an interesting way into the story, not just because HBO is paying me to be interested in it, but it's just, I mean, that's what I love in storytelling is finding the human angle. Finding the character, finding what do these people do when they go home? Yep. What is it like at home? That's fascinating to me. Yeah. How are you processing this privately?
Right.
What effect has it had on your family and your relationships? All of that to me is like the most interesting stuff of any political scandal or any political drama. So that angle, I think, is really fascinating.
And a lot of what you're doing in the podcast, it seems, is trying to unpack that too, right? And understand the people and explain like how the writers came to them.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, I think any subject that feels like it's been covered to death, that we've had every angle on, when there is a novel way in, I'm very fascinated by how the idea is formed and how they decide to approach it. And it's this sort of unusual mix of like buddy comedy and family tragedy I think is really interesting. I mean, I am the target audience, but I do think it's very interesting. I thought Dave Mandel did a really great job.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20
and use promo code LAWFARE20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
He's on the first episode of your podcast, right, talking about kind of how he went about creating the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, do I have this right, that it's his father who hooked him up with...
That's Dave Burnett. That's Dave Burnett. A producer on the show.
Yeah. Who hooked him up with Bug Crow, or like Eagle Crow.
Yeah.
who was telling him this story, like, no, really? Like, I mean, it's a story that people kind of knew, but an angle that nobody had taken by telling it through the story of Lydian Hunt.
Yeah, in Burnett's telling... basically, his dad, who this does seem to be true anecdotally, I've now met his dad a few times, he has just a million ideas for TV shows, and like they're all always horrible. And then this one time he pitched him, and it's like, oh, that is a great idea. That's a great idea for a show. And Dave Mandel is the director, who, of course, is from Veep. And Seinfeld, and
which seems like a very good sensibility to be bringing to the subject.
Yeah, definitely. I love thinking though about like what would Watergate have been like with the cast of Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think to that point too, it's like it's been said many times now, but like the show that actually is Washington is not House of Cards; it's Veep.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's.
Yeah. Well, it's true. The absurdity of it, right? And I think like. And I think you talk about this in the first episode, too. And this is true about the Watergate
House
era.
A little House of Cards sometimes.
Thinking
about it, yeah.
You used to make this observation that Washington is a small town. And, like, it was a small town during Watergate. It's still a small town now. And I think that one of the – I often am wondering, why does Watergate still resonate? It's more than 50 years ago.
It's like a high school lore, you know, like, oh, remember the time the seniors put the car on the roof?
Yeah, exactly. Like, remember the time they broke into the psychiatrist's office?
Yeah.
What do you think about, like, why it's still – it still looms so large, and it's fascinating. I mean, there's a television show, and you're doing a podcast about Watergate. There's a book that just Garrett Graff, who's your historian and guy, just was a finalist for the Pulitzer.
I think because it's such a human story. Yeah. It's like this story about remarkable smallness in people and human error and just bad judgment and bad morals. That's just kind of endlessly adaptable and fascinating. And like a lot of political intrigue, there are a million different ways to look at it and a million different fascinating characters. I mean, I still think about Slober and the Leon Neyfakh approach to it. And there are things that I'm still learning about Watergate, like Dorothy Hunt, for instance, who comes up a lot in this show. I did not know anything about Dorothy Hunt, and I did not know anything about – I can't spoil anything. I don't know what episode this all – But I feel silly to not want to spoil something that's like highly Wikipedia-able. But
I don't want to ruin history for you.
Don't want to ruin it, but
spoiler,
he goes on.
He does resign.
I've been warned to not ruin anything. But yeah, and or even like
Martha Mitchell.
I was going to say Martha Mitchell, The Mouth of the South. Yeah, a documentary.
Oh, it's really good.
No, I didn't think it was good. I didn't think they did a great job.
Why? Was it too short? Well, I will say I felt it was too short, and they didn't have enough room to like do the connective tissue bit.
Yeah,
but
it was
too
montage-y.
Okay, yeah,
I mean, they don't have
fair.
Her,
that's
so
fair.
It's
that's
they did
fair.
The best they could in that respect. I thought Sally Quinn was great in it, though.
Okay, yeah, good explainer.
I thought she was great.
Can carry it through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think it really did her justice as a character. But maybe that's impossible with someone who was not, you know, I don't know.
And
a
in
lot of
30
people
minutes.
A lot of people, yeah, it was very short.
It was a short form.
It was
short. Yeah. But to your point, though, it's like some of these characters are so outsized, even for a story as big as Watergate.
Right.
That is really saying something.
Yeah.
And there are still figures around. I mean, even in Trump orbit.
I mean,
like
Roger Stone.
Sure.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, not that he was an essential component of Watergate, although he takes credit for, you know, the sun rising. And he's like ISIS. But the fact that he's, you know, an artifact of American history and also – a character affecting ongoing American drama is fascinating.
And, and I think that's a good point, too, about, like, again, why Watergate resonates. I mean, some of these characters are still here. There are journalists that you and I both know who covered that period. I mean, it does.
I ran into Bernstein at a party a few months ago, mm-hmm. and I wanted to kind of fangirl over his memoir about his early days as a reporter before he gets – it kind of ends when he gets to the Washington Post.
Right.
I loved it, and I was sort of gushing about this. And he looks over my shoulder and he said, hold on. Hold that thought. I got to go find Woodward. And I just thought, like, what – what a life. How is it possible that in Washington, all of these years later, decades and decades later, Bernstein is still looking for Woodward in Sally Quinn's house? And I am bearing witness to this now.
Oh, my God. I think it's both, like, it's both poignant and sad.
Yeah, I felt like Forrest Gump, you know? Like.
But this is the small town.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Do you like that about Washington?
I think it still shocks me.
Uh-huh.
Because I kind of – all the things that people say about how much better New York is, most of them are correct. But it's not – you know, I always felt like Washington's not nearly as bad as people in New York make it sound like will be.
For sure.
And there's so much beauty and texture to the city that outside of it you don't hear a lot of appreciation for. But it is small.
Yeah.
It is small. When you don't leave your bubble here, it is suffocatingly small. And in New York, I mean, not to be like – but I always just think, you know, if you're like crying on the street in New York or something, no one's going to give a shit.
Right.
If you're crying on the street here, you, like, Chuck Schumer might emerge and give you a tissue.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
It's just a very different.
Yeah. It's both charming and stifling at the same time.
Yeah. It's funny. I brought a lot of, I've had some guests with me at the Correspondents' Dinner from Los Angeles, mm-hmm. And who I'm working with on a project. And there was a lot of comparing LA and DC because it's
very similar.
Very
much the same town.
No, it's very similar, right? But the meaningful difference my producer Gina kept pointing out was that in LA, no one's really friends.
Mm.
When you're out at a party, whereas here, I mean, we've all survived sometimes literal wars together.
Yes.
I see you at a party, I like run across the room to tackle you, right?
Yeah.
And I have so many wonderful friends here, and even people that I'm not close friends with, you have a bond with usually, right? Because you have experienced this really real shit, mm-hmm. meaningful shit together. And I guess that kind of shocked the LA people who were here that weekend, and I thought that was so fascinating.
It's so, and I worked for LA early, and worked in LA. I worked for the government of Los Angeles
for Hollywood.
Yes, I worked for Hollywood. I worked for peanuts. I did work for peanuts, but I worked at a magazine in LA early in my career for about a year, and I'd done an internship at a small film production company when I was in college.
Really? So which one?
It was called what the hell was it called? Oh God, wait. Oh, Tapestry Films. The two things they were famous for were the producers. One, they did Point Break, the original. And two, they produced all the Olsen twin videos.
Oh, amazing.
Which means
God.
Trillionaires now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And at the time, I was not impressed, but
oh,
whatever.
My God. No, they were like little reporters on some of those series.
Yeah.
They did investigations. They wore trench coats. A lot of my aesthetic references come from Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen.
The early years.
Well, now, of course, they have the row. So
yeah, exactly.
You can buy a $5,000 trench coat from
them.
Sure,
why not? And an appropriate size now, too. But I found both going between L.A. and Washington, totally, I was like, they're the same place. I mean, they're both one-horse industry towns. They both think that the work that they're doing is the center of the universe and the most important thing. They're absolutely obsessed with image and, you know, celebrity in their different ways.
Yeah.
With clout, it is about who you know.
Yep.
LA, there's much more money, but money is just sort of like kind of like part of the current. That's
right.
All. It's really about clout, and clout does not necessarily equate to money.
Yeah,
same
I mean,
as
I
in
think
DC.
The meaningful distinction is like they're glamour and aesthetics looms so
large,
right? And people are so obsessed with that stuff, right? We're here, obviously. It's not a major fixation.
We don't lead with it.
We don't lead with that. And the jargon, you know, all the jargony or just the kind of nicknames for people and first names where it's like when you're parachuting in, you're like, what the hell are people? Who is Pete? What are you guys talking about? Right.
Right.
And you really, it takes, I mean, I'm still learning about LA, but like it takes a while to kind of learn the language and the pattern of how people speak.
How do you like the city, LA?
I love it.
Yeah.
I really love LA.
I do too. I hated it when I lived there, but now I like
really?
It
Really? Where did you live?
I live in Venice.
Why didn't you like it?
Well, it's more that I think it wasn't a particularly the thing about Venice. It was more that LA, I mean, it's not a beautiful city per se, and that it's very sprawling and spread out. There are gorgeous parts of it. Mm-hmm. LA is the kind of thing where you kind of have to, like, you know, put the little like box around your eyes and just look at some pieces of it. It's like, it's not like Washington, where I think where you can walk out and there are just expanses of the city that are actually quite designed and beautiful.
And walkable.
Although
Will O'Connor is, our friend Will O'Connor is adamant about walking in LA. And so I've kind of experienced it a little bit with him that way, which
takes
is very
a long
interesting.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah, I left him in a park to go take an Uber home recently.
I'll see you in 3 hours.
I know.
Across town. But no, I think also I was just at a point in my life, too, when I lived there where I was just very serious and I was just coming out and everything was very weighty. And I think I wanted more of the intellectual climate of Washington. The thing that I didn't understand is that people in LA are also very smart. It's just they don't necessarily present in the same way as, you know, they're in Washington, people want you to know they're smart.
Right.
In LA, people aren't striving.
There's also a baseline here, though, right?
There's a baseline here.
Kind of, you have to have a certain level. You at least have to be knowledgeable about what's happening to have a conversation, usually.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, but it is a town that is genuinely fascinated with this town. This town is also very fascinated by them. I mean, the correspondence dinner is kind of like the galactic collision every year where you see that happening. But I think that, you know, what intrigued me about wanting to come back to Washington, and it took me years to figure this out, it's not so much that I wanted to be in Washington doing a Washington thing. I was just fascinated by the stories that were in Washington.
Right.
I went to LA to be a storyteller because I thought I would work in screenwriting, and that's what I'd always wanted to do. And I realized that, no, actually, it's like it's the drama of this town that actually intrigues me and pulls me in, which is why I just stayed here and did journalism.
Right.
Now, as I'm older, I love going back to LA and spending time there. I like it more than New York.
Oh, I do too. Yeah, which is shocking for
me to say.
Yeah,
I would never thought
I
would
say
that.
I mean, I used to joke that, you know, I'll certainly die in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully no time soon. And I always was sort of thinking, like, I can't wait to get back to New York. I can't wait to get back to New York. And I love New York. And I always feel like a just utter relief when I'm back there.
Yeah.
And I never feel lost or uneasy there. Just, you know, I really have my bearings in New York. But I feel that same relief now when I land in L.A.
That's nice.
I love L.A.
I really
think it's just a great, great town. I love driving. And
yeah.
I love how, like,
as a New Yorker, you love driving.
And I love how psychotic the LA drivers are. I think it's, like, amazing. So, yeah.
What do you, in working as you are now with creative people, you know, I don't know if they're literally in Hollywood, but I mean, you're working with, you know, filmmakers now. Do they come to a story like Watergate and a story like Washington kind of like with sets of preconceived notions? I mean, is it baked in or do they kind of approach it like, let's tell this story anew?
I mean, I think with the White House Plumber series, which I was not involved with the making of the series, but I think it's clear that, I mean, Mandel, the director, had learned a lot from Veep. I mean, they were constantly bringing in experts on, you know, I'm making this up, but like, I need an expert on the Secret Service. Get me a former agent. And you know, Tammy Haddad would materialize former agent who would come and brief everybody, or maybe Mitt Romney would come in, or you know, whoever they needed to talk to. He was constantly doing interviews and learning a lot. And so he's really, really plugged into Washington and very knowledgeable about it. And I think that's reflected in kind of how the tone of the show, I think, is very Washington.
You have to have that, right? Otherwise, it's going to come across as phony.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think
like, even to a viewer who doesn't know what Washington's really like, you know when something isn't ringing true.
Right, and it's still just, it's a place. It's an ecosystem.
Yeah.
It's a neighborhood. It's a universe of people. And, like, no matter where you're, if you're setting something at a dog show or in, you know, Fargo or wherever. It doesn't matter. It has to feel like a real place with a real community.
Right.
But I don't know that any of the preconceived notions about Washington are necessarily wrong so much as they're incomplete.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you talked about, you know, the smallness and the pettiness of, you know, it was exemplified in Watergate. I don't know that ever goes away. I just think that's I think that's endemic to politics.
Yeah.
People making bad decisions.
Yeah.
Because ultimately the things that they want, they're going to have to do some bad things to get them.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that that I thought was interesting from my producer, Gina, her analysis of Washington was she did not realize how a lot of the people working in more junior positions in a White House or administration are there, but they could really be anywhere else. They could be at, you know, in corporate America. Mm-hmm. They could be working in fashion. They could be in any sort of similar functionary position in a range of different places. And it's not just true believers. It's not just ideologues. It's not just people whose entire life is about climbing a ladder here. I thought that was kind of fascinating. Yeah. I think there's a tendency to just sort of flatten any place into stereotypes, into West Wing.
Yeah, they're all ambitious and want to be the chief of staff of the White House.
Which is not strictly true.
No, I mean, that's such a smart point, too. I mean, I think of, you know, the number of people, too, that I've met here who were, like, in my first 5 years living here who aren't here anymore. And they went off and did something like that. And you look back at their time in Washington, they're like, yeah, I did that thing there. And now I did something similar in New York or Chicago or Nashville or whatever.
But I understand that, too. I mean, do you, where I kind of feel like when you've been in a place for what feels like a chapter, thinking, oh, you know, maybe I want to figure out a different way to communicate.
Yeah. I mean, when I went to go, well, when I met you is when I went to go work at the Beast, was at a point where I was working in magazines. My career was reversed. I started in magazines then went into daily news because I didn't I wanted something different.
Right.
And I was like, I want to stay here. I want to keep doing journalism, but I want to radically change how I'm doing it and the kind that I'm doing. And like that was easy enough to do.
Right.
I mean, the city does have dimensions and layers and a kind of multitudes to it, I think, that way. And it is a media capital. I mean, it's not New York, but it's a major media center. And I think we have so many of these things just kind of in miniature.
Yeah.
You know, if that makes sense. Do you like podcasting? Speaking of like now switching into other ways of communicating and telling stories?
Yeah. I mean, what I like about it is how much more social it feels. Mm-hmm. I mean, feature writing can be really isolating.
Truly.
And as you, as you well know, and it's just nice to be collaborative. Mm-hmm. So anything that's not writing alone in a room is great fun to me.
Because you're writing, you're working from home probably all the time, or you're writing at home.
I love writing at home. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Or I'm in a hotel.
Yeah.
You know. And I love writing.
Yeah.
So I mean, there was a period of time in the Trump administration when I started working on the project that I'm working on now, which is a series for AMC. Mm-hmm. I had reached a point in my reporting where I really thought I had horrible writer's block, and I was just devastated by it and having so much trouble just getting a sentence out, whereas it used to just be like off to the races once I started typing. And I was just so perplexed and sad about it. And then I realized, oh, I don't have writer's block. I don't want to talk to these people anymore block. And I'm tired of these people block. I'm tired of this reporting block. And so I started writing it as what I thought would be like a, I thought I would release like maybe an anonymous novel, like Primary Colors. And I realized, I don't hate writing. I love writing.
Yeah.
So I don't mind being alone writing.
Yeah.
But it's very nice to break that up with any kind of creative, collaborative thing.
So does this mean if he's reelected, you're like, no, not doing it. I'm not writing about you anymore.
No, I have to do it.
You do. Okay. Because you did say you feel like it's a mission.
I have to see it through.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know that I could do the kind of daily, not that I was ever doing a daily grind, but I was there most days.
You have to pay attention to it every day.
Yeah. And I was there most days. Right. I mean, my entire waking life, like yours was probably, was waking up, reading the news, listening to the news when I reached a I can't read anymore block, and or just in piles and piles of books that were coming out that were relevant to what we were covering, or just it was ceaseless.
Yeah.
every day, all day,
yeah,
until I went to sleep.
Yeah, it's completely exhausting.
Yeah,
in a way
like
that
a fire hose.
No, like, totally. And I would try to tell even like reporters who I work with who never covered another White House. I was like, this is so abnormal. It's a busy job covering any administration.
I mean, it's been shocking, the transition to Biden for me.
It's a livable life,
basically. I mean, I knew it wasn't normal, right? Yeah. But I had never experienced normalcy.
Right.
So even if I'm like, well, this doesn't seem right.
Right. No, totally.
It's still, what I had nothing to compare it to. But thankfully, at the White House, there's so many like lifers there and so many people among the photographers and producers who have been there since, you know, Carter.
Exactly.
I could talk about it. Yeah, since Watergate.
I'm with you, though. Like, I had this debate with, like, Joe and I talked about this, where I was like, if he were reelected, I'm like, am I really – like, could I do 4 more years of this? And I was kind of a mindset of, like, I think it's just so exhausting and I don't know if I want to do it. And I changed my mind on that. I'm like, it's like, A, it's a great story, but B, it's like, if I don't do what I'm doing, who else is going to do that job?
Well, I also keep thinking – I was having a conversation with a reporter who was interviewing me about something related to Trump. And I, obviously a younger reporter or just a green reporter, and this person had no knowledge seemingly of a lot of basic shit that had happened in the Trump administration or just dynamics, not like no knowledge of what, but just like no memory of what the briefings were like, no memory of the experience of it. And how could you if you didn't experience it? It was just something coming by on your screen, right?
Sure.
And I just was thinking like, oh boy. Oh, no. We really need people who remember stuff personally to be
absolutely
reporting on this.
Completely. And I think and you and I have learned from people like that. So
you
have to stay on the job and just continue doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. But hopefully it won't be that exhausting. We're going to see what happens. Well, our tradition on the show here is my last question. As I get to reach into the chatterbox.
Beautiful.
Isn't
Wait,
so
did
pretty?
Joe make it?
No, he did not make this. He could have, though.
Yeah.
Well, it would have been even nicer. And I'm going to pull out a random question that's been previously typed down for you. Okay. Let's see. Oh, this is a good one. I like this for you. And I like this for you. In what country other than your own, as in here, would you most like to live and why?
Huh. I guess Italy.
Yeah. You seem noncommittal about that.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, I guess I would want to live in Italy.
Yeah. Do you speak Italian?
No, I really want to learn.
Yeah.
I want to get a tutor to learn because I tried doing it like with Duolingo or whatever and it didn't take at all with all the phrases that you would never use. You know, the boy has an apple. but I really want to learn and Ryan and I want to get married there. So I want to learn before we do that so that it's not a...
Do you know where your people come from? In like...
Yeah, Bari and Avellino.
Oh, nice.
And Ryan's family's from Benevento.
Okay. Okay.
Sort of nearby Avellino, which makes me a little nervous.
Yeah.
Are we related?
Yeah. Yes, possible. That's not Italian. Where are you going to get married in Italy?
I don't know yet. We're not totally sure. Probably we got engaged in Capri, so maybe back there.
Yeah. Yeah. So Italy.
Yeah.
That'll work.
I think so.
You could cover, there's lots of Italian
politics.
Well,
right after we got engaged and the next day we went to cover the election there.
It's so romantic.
It was so romantic. It really, it was, though.
Two political reporters.
We just really wanted to, you know. Oh, there's a rally. Let's go.
It's like you want to believe at the end of the day, it's like you just kick back and talk about anything other than politics. But it's
either movies or politics.
Yeah. That's good. Well, my friend Olivia Nuzzi, thank you for coming over here today.
Thank you for
having
me.
This has been fun.
Yeah.
We caused a little trouble.
A little? I feel like we didn't.
We could do more.
Yeah. Anything? I feel like we didn't.
Any shit you want to talk real quick before we say goodbye?
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.